Good morning. Glad to be with you all this week. Very glad for this opportunity. This morning I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about a character in the Bible who's a lot like Daniel in the respect that he, at a very early age, rose to a position of prominence in a foreign land and was a great influence on that land, and that's the man Joseph. It's amazing to think what Joseph accomplished by the age of 35 or so. I'm 37, and I look at my life, and I think, wow, I haven't risen to second in command in the nation I live in. And yet Joseph had done that, not from a position of privilege or not from a position of advantage, but rather from a slave. And in the story of Joseph, just like in the story of Daniel, we see God's hand at work. I'd like to take just a little different approach to Joseph today, rather than look at the book, chapter, verse, story of Joseph, beginning in Genesis 37 and onward. I'd instead like to place Joseph in a context, a historical and archaeological context. And in order to do that, I'm going to assume a level of familiarity on your part with his story. So hopefully, sometime in the recent past, you've read through the story of Joseph, you're familiar with what happens, and I'll try as we go along to narrate some of the passages in particular. We won't be looking at everything in his story, just a few things that I find interesting. And we'll begin in the 37th chapter of Joseph, in verse number 2, with a phrase that pops up a lot in the book of Genesis. In Genesis 37:2, we see the statement, "This is the history of Jacob." If you've read through the book of Genesis lately, or just calling back into your own memory, you'll recall that this phrase pops up a lot throughout the book of Genesis. This is the history, or these are the genealogies. The New American Standard says these are the records of the generations. And as I've noted up here on the PowerPoint, hopefully that's big enough to read, we find that statement in Genesis 6, verse 9, chapter 10, verse 1, chapter 11, verse 10 and 27, chapter 25, verse 12 and 19, chapter 36, verses 1 and 9, and here in chapter 37, verse 2. That's a statement that comes up time and time and time again. And that word generation, in some translations it's rendered history, that word generation is from the Hebrew word toledoth. And that word basically represents a history, a family's history, a story of their origins. This is what's known as a colophon phrase. A man by the name of P.J. Weissman, back in 1936, wrote a book called Ancient Records and the Structure of Genesis. And through a survey of Mesopotamian literature, what he determined was that this was something that happened quite a lot in the ancient world, particularly in Mesopotamia. In Mesopotamia, they had the practice of writing the name of the owner, or the name of the author, at the end of a clay tablet. And what he also found was, if you had multiple tablets that were sort of placed together, you would find these catch lines put in the middle of those tablets to connect one tablet to another. And this led him to what he calls the tablet theory. If you're wondering where I'm going with this, just stick with me for a second, and I hope some of this will begin to make some sense. The tablet theory goes something like this. He theorized that Moses took documents that were already existing and compiled them to create the book that we call Genesis. Now, this is common in the Old Testament. For instance, in the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles, we have a compilation of an historical record. And that historical record begins with the genealogy of the various tribes. It then goes to the reign of David and Solomon. And then it follows the reigns of all the kings of Judah. And when we get to the end of 2 Chronicles, there's some indication that Ezra, the scribe who came on the scene later on after the Babylonian and Persian captivity, there's some indication that Ezra, by the divine direction of God, had compiled this history from sources that existed already, and by the inspiration of the Lord was able to put together these books that we call 1 and 2 Chronicles. The tablet theory proposes much the same thing, that Moses took documents that were already existing and compiled them to create Genesis. So he creates this narrative from what we would call a group of tablets. The records, he theorized, were preserved by Seth's line, by Noah, and by Shem through Arphaxad. Remember, Shem had many descendants, and Arphaxad would be the one through whom the holy lineage would come, if you will. Moses then took those records that already existed, and he wrote out the book of Genesis as we have it on what's called vellum, or sheepskin. And this would have been the practice of writing that would have been in practice during his day. What I think is really interesting about this is, if that theory is true, what we have in the book of Genesis is a narrative that stretches back quite literally to the beginning of time. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, and notice what's said there. Back in Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, says, this is the genealogy, or the generations, or the history of Noah. This is one of those colophon phrases. It appears at the end of an account. If the tablet theory is correct, what we have read just prior to this is something that Noah had recorded for his posterity. And as we go back earlier, in earlier chapters of the book of Genesis, you could make the same argument concerning Seth and concerning Adam as well. If the tablet theory is true, what we have then in the book of Genesis is a compilation of some of the oldest writings that have existed in mankind's history, stretching all the way back to our very beginnings from our father, Adam. I think it's a fascinating theory, and I wanted to bring it up here at the beginning because I think it's interesting that here in the 37th chapter of Genesis, when we come into the story of Joseph, we see this statement, this is the history, or these are the generations, or this is the genealogy, however your Bible might render that, this is the history of Jacob. So everything that's come before this has been essentially Jacob's writing, and what we have from this point forward is a new author, an author that Moses has taken and by the inspiration of God has placed in this book we call Genesis. So up here I've got just a little table just to kind of give you an idea of what exactly I'm talking about. Maybe if none of this has really made any sense, maybe this table will help clarify it. So Wiseman proposed that there were essentially 11 tablets. The first, he said, was written, he theorized, by Adam. And then he also kind of recanted on that and thought maybe Moses had done that. And that begins in chapter 1, verse 1, and ends in chapter 2, verse 4, the first part of verse 4 in chapter 2. And then in chapter 2, verse 4, down through chapter 5, verse 1, we have Adam's account. In chapter 5, verse 1, down to chapter 6, verse 9, we have Noah's account, and so on and so forth. If Wiseman's correct, I think this is quite convicting. Because here we have the descendants of Adam, the descendants of Noah, the descendants of Shem, carrying along with them this ancient record coming to us all the way through Moses, down through the centuries into our hands. I'll just throw that out there as a possibility. And of course, the last tablet Wiseman theorized began in chapter 37, verse 2, letter B, which would be the second half of that verse, and concluded in Exodus chapter 1, verse 6. So there's a little bit of an overlap into the book of Exodus. About 40 years ago, a young man who was in college was told by a professor that Moses could not have written the first five books of the Bible because writing did not exist at the time Moses lived. Moses wrote these five books, or compiled Genesis and wrote those other five books, four books, excuse me, I can't do my addition this morning, sometime between 1446 B.C. and 1406 B.C. I believe the Exodus took place in 1446. I believe the invasion of Canaan took place somewhere around 1406. And somewhere in between, in those intervening 40 years, God revealed these things to Moses. Moses took the time to compile these things, and he put them together. This young man, 40 years ago, was told by his professor that this could not have happened, that Moses could not have written these things down, because writing did not exist at his time. Well, we didn't have the internet, and this young man could not verify his professor's statement, so he took it as fact. And as a result, his faith was overthrown, and he left the Lord. The professor could not have been more wrong. I don't know if the professor knew better and was just veiling the truth, or whether he just didn't know better at the time, and discoveries since then have disproven him. But we know for a fact that ancient writing stretches back at least 1,000 years before Moses, and probably more than just that. Up here I've got a picture of the city of Ebla, and there's a picture of a man holding a little clay tablet there. That's the writing that we often call cuneiform. In Ebla, which was an ancient Semitic city in northern Syria, we discovered in 1968 a whole lot of clay tablets. And by 1974 and 75, we had discovered some 20,000 royal and public records that date from approximately 2500 BC to 2250 BC. That's fully 1,000 years before Moses came on the scene. And now, when you go through social studies and you learn about the Mesopotamians or the Sumerians, and later on the Egyptians, it is taught that writing was around long before Moses came on the scene. I bring this up not because this is necessary for us to believe the Bible, but as an illustration of what I think is a critical fact. Not everything that's said in the scholarly community can be corroborated by archaeology and history. Some of the assertions that they make about the Bible are made in direct opposition to the Bible because they don't believe the Bible. There's bias there. Now, right around the time this man was misled was right around the time that all this discovering of ancient Mesopotamian text was made in the city of Ebla. The scholarly community is not on our side. Most of them do not accept the Bible as an accurate historical account. And they are going to speak against it when they have opportunity. Not because they're objective, not because they're honest, but because they have an agenda. They oppose what the Bible has to say. And as I've already made mention, these tablets were written in cuneiform in a language that's similar to Hebrew. These were written in a Semitic language similar to Hebrew. So that's all I really want to say about Genesis 37 and 2. Writing had been around well before Moses came on the scene. That Moses, if the tablet theory is correct, had compiled these things, created the book of Genesis, and this is what we have in our hands today. Perhaps, if it is true, we have some of the oldest writing known to mankind. Writing that may date back to the very man who began the human race. Alright, so let's get into Joseph for a few minutes here, now that we've kind of set the stage. Joseph, in chapter 37, is betrayed by his brothers. It's a story that I think we're all familiar with. And there's a few insightful statements in this chapter. His brothers say, as they betray him, we're going to see what will become of his dreams. Joseph has already put off his family, a little bit his father to some extent. When he has that dream about the sun, moon, and stars, his father says, "Shall your mother and I bow down to you as well?" He's a little incredulous at this idea that Joseph is going to rise and become preeminent among his brothers. And his brothers are jealous, made jealous by this. And they say, let's find out what this dreamer of dreams, what these dreams will come of. That he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. That was said about Reuben. Remember, Reuben had made a big mistake earlier. He had had an illicit affair with one of his father's concubines. His father had found out about it, and it does seem, based on what we read in 1 Chronicles, that Reuben had, from that point forward, lost his birthright. His birthright was handed to the sons of Joseph instead. They were given the double portion, rather than Reuben. And it seems that Reuben, in all of this, was sort of conspiring. Well, it wasn't conspiring because he was all by himself. He was working to get back into his father's favor. He allowed his brothers to do this thing to Joseph, and yet in the back of his mind, he's thinking, well, maybe I can make Dad happy again. And this just gives us some insight into the horrible dysfunction of Jacob's family. This was an incredibly dysfunctional family, and a lot of that dysfunction was the result of partiality on Jacob's part. Favoritism destroys, and we see that lesson hammered home in the story of Joseph and his betrayal by his brothers. They ask that question, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? In other words, they're not just looking to get rid of their brother, they're trying to turn a little bit of a profit in this. And that's why they see this caravan of Midianites and Ishmaelites off in the distance, and they decide at that moment that not only can they get rid of this little dreamer, they can also make a little bit of money in the process. Now they sell Joseph for 20 shekels of silver. In the Code of Hammurabi, law number 252 states, if a goring ox kills a man's slave, he shall pay one-third of a mina. Now the Code of Hammurabi came around somewhere around 2000 BC, I don't know the exact year, but probably about 300 or 400 years before Joseph was alive. It's been around for a long time. And the Code of Hammurabi basically codified, put into writing, some of the customs and practices that were already existing among these ancient peoples. And one of them was, if you've got an ox that gores a man's slave, then the owner of the ox needs to make restitution. He needs to pay 20 shekels of silver for that slave. A mina is 60 shekels, one-third of a mina would be 20 shekels, and this corresponds to what we see over in Leviticus chapter 27, verse 5. Basically, God took the customs of the day, perhaps God had revealed these customs to man many, many centuries before, but he took this custom, and that's the basis, in some respects, for Leviticus chapter 27, verse 5. Same law is codified by God as well. So here we have Joseph and his brothers up in Shechem. And what's interesting about this area is there is a major road that passes through this valley. Joseph probably went from this area down to Egypt on a road known as the Way of the Sea, or in Latin it's called Via Maris, the Way of the Sea. This trade route dates to the early Bronze Age, somewhere around 3300 to 2100 BC. And, you know, I'm skeptical of carbon dating for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reason to be skeptical about it. So these dates that I'm throwing out here, this is just scholarly conjecture, scholarly prediction. I don't know how accurate it is, but we know with a great deal of confidence that this road had been here for a while before Joseph. This was a road that cut through this area. That was the road that the Midianites and the Ishmaelites were traveling on. And this road linked Egypt with Syria, which would have been up in the north, Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey or Asia Minor, and Mesopotamia. So this was a major road that ran through this area. I don't know if you can see this up on the map very well, but if you look up there in Palestine, do I have a laser pointer up here somewhere? Any laser pointers? No? Is this a laser pointer? Perfect. I don't know how well you can see this, but this purple road right here, if you can see that, that's the Way of the Sea right there. And it cuts right here between these two points. It looks like Hazor and a name I can't read very well. I think that's Dock, maybe? I don't know, Door? Anyways, it runs right between these two cities, that little straight line. That's right through the valley of Jezreel. That would have been right around the area that Joseph and his brothers were when he was betrayed. So in all likelihood, here's just another view of it that might be a little bit better. You can kind of see the road, how it runs right here through the valley of Jezreel, and then cuts back down. I think I just lost my... Oh, nope, there it is. I can't see the laser pointer, so we'll just keep on going. You can see how it cuts through the valley of Jezreel. Interestingly, in Jezreel, we also have Megiddo is there in Jezreel. And one of the interesting things about Megiddo is it's right around Nazareth. Nazareth is up on a bluff, and it's quite likely that Jesus, as a boy, stood on the bluff there at Nazareth, looked down at the valley of Jezreel, looked down at Megiddo, and you have to wonder, what was he thinking to himself, the man who would later, in the book of Revelation, reveal through his angels to the prophet John, the apostle John, that there would be a great battle between God's people and the forces of the world that occurred at a place he calls Armageddon or Harmageddon, which would be this valley. Now, I don't believe in a literal interpretation of that. I believe that's a spiritualization, that we may be seeing some of that, some of the foundation of that being laid in our day and age today. But anyways, just to give you a little bit of extra material here. So cutting through this valley of Jezreel, right around the area where Joseph and his brothers were at when he was betrayed, would have been this major trade route, and that's probably how Joseph got from this point down to Egypt. Here's a picture of it. You can see the Jezreel Valley off in the distance, back behind there, the mountains are... I guess they'd be called mountains. They look more like hills kind of in this picture. And then that road there, which is now a highway, is on the old roadbed of the Way of the Sea. So it still exists to a degree or to a certain extent today. Now, this is an interesting papyrus that's from the Middle Kingdom of Egypt. This papyrus is interesting because this is some archaeological verification that the Egyptians did use Semitic peoples as slaves. This was the Wilbur Papyrus Roll. It was purchased by Charles Wilbur in Thebes in 1881, and it's been held by the Brooklyn Museum. I don't know. That writing's pretty small. I don't know if you can read that very well or not. On this papyrus, we find a list of names, nationalities, and titles and jobs of Egyptian slaves. Now, Joseph's name's not on this list, but what's interesting is this papyrus would come from just right around the time of Joseph. There are 95 slaves listed, 30 are non-Egyptian. More specifically, those slaves are Asiatic, just like Joseph would have been. Several of the names on that papyrus are similar to names found in the Old Testament. I'm not trying to put out any linkage between the two, just saying that this papyrus has on it names that would have been common among the people that we read about in the Bible. Occupations that are listed there could be classified as skilled laborers, perhaps like masons. That would be a skilled laborer. Or someone who worked in metals, that would be skilled labor. One of the most common titles on this papyrus was household servant, which is what Joseph ends up being, isn't it? That's what he ends up as a household servant to Potiphar, right? Potiphar, who was a captain of Pharaoh's guard. So this papyrus just shows us that... That this was a common practice in Joseph's day and age. We have a papyrus that goes right back to that time. We've got non-Egyptian names listed there. 30 of them are Asiatic. They're similar to the names that we find in the Old Testament. Occupations that were skilled labor in nature, which Joseph would have been a skilled laborer. He worked for Potiphar. He became a steward in Potiphar's household, and that would be a skilled position, I would think. And we also see on this papyrus that slaves were commonly owned by wealthy individuals. And of course, Potiphar, as a captain of Pharaoh's guard, would have been one of the wealthier men in ancient Egypt. I'll just stop here and pause. Any questions or comments down through the end of chapter 37? Anything that I've left unclear? You want to just keep pushing forward. Before I keep going, what time do I need to stop? Anybody know? This is really important. 25 after? All right, okay, good, very good. It's really important that I know that, otherwise I might just go into somebody else's time. All right, let's get into chapter 39 now. And Joseph's encounter with Potiphar's wife. So Joseph has been placed as head over all of Potiphar's household. There's some indication in the Hebrew language that when Joseph was shepherding with his brothers there at the beginning of Genesis 37, that Jacob had placed him in a position of authority over his older brothers. That argument can be made from the Hebrew that he was sort of the head or chief shepherd over his brothers. If that's correct, I think what we see with Joseph is a young man with a lot of capabilities. If that's not true in chapter 37, if Joseph hadn't been placed in a position of authority over his brothers back then, I think we could definitely make that assertion in chapter 39, that Joseph was, without question, a very talented and capable young man. Now, I'm not trying to diminish the providence of God here. By no means am I doing that. As Joseph himself later acknowledges to his brothers when they're worried about him exacting his revenge after their father's death, he says, listen, God placed me here for a reason. God placed me in this position to help our family survive. So I don't want to diminish God's hand in this because Joseph acknowledges it. But I do think we could say with a great deal of certainty, at least by chapter 39, that with Joseph, we have a young man with great capabilities. And the same could be said of Daniel as well. There's another piece of linkage between Daniel and Joseph. That Daniel was also a man of great learning, great capabilities, and he rose quickly because of those capabilities and because of God's providential hand. So here's Joseph in Potiphar's household. He's managing everything. The only thing that's been withheld from him is his master's wife, as he says in this temptation. Now, one of the things that we don't often talk about in our Bible study is how adultery was handled in ancient Egypt. Now, Joseph wasn't guilty of adultery, but he was accused of it, wasn't he? Potiphar's wife tried to accuse him of making an advance toward her, which would have been tantamount to adultery. And I've got a rather lengthy quotation here, but I think this kind of gives us an indication as to how the adulterer would have been viewed and how he would have been treated in ancient Egypt. Beginning the quotation, in ancient Egypt, adultery was an offense against the gods, the abomination of Montu, and I've put Montu up here, who is the god of war and the protector of the happy home. Papyrus Westcar, which is just one of those fragment papyruses that we have, Papyrus Westcar mentions drowning for the lover and burning followed by drowning for the woman. In practice, the community seems instead to have pressured the husband to cast out his wayward wife and to confiscate her bride gift. Wives reputed to be adulteresses were allowed to clear themselves by an oath. One husband had his wife's lover banished with mutilation of the nose and ears. The adulterer would probably also be expelled from any religious association to which he belonged. Adultery on the part of the man seems to have been grounds for a court-ordered divorce. This just kind of gives you a sense of how adulterers were treated. And the reason I bring this up is because what does Pharaoh do with Joseph? Does he mutilate him? No, doesn't cut off his nose, doesn't cut off his hands. He has him thrown into prison, right? This was a little out of the ordinary for the customs of this time. And I think that that may give us an indication that Pharaoh probably wasn't fully convinced by his wife's story. I think Potiphar was not fully convinced by his wife's story. I think Potiphar may have shown some mercy toward Joseph in this situation, perhaps because he had profited by Joseph. Joseph had been a faithful steward up to this point. But he is very lenient with Joseph. Now you think, well, he threw him in jail. That doesn't seem to be lenient. Well, I mean, in comparison to burning, it's pretty lenient, right? In comparison to mutilation, this seems to be an act of mercy. So that leads us to the question, I mean, why was Potiphar lenient? Well, you just have to wonder, did he really believe his wife's story? Was he softened by the material benefit that Joseph had brought as a steward? Did he sense that Joseph had the hand of God with him? I mean, it just makes you wonder. The other thing that I think is interesting about the story of Joseph is that prisons were pretty uncommon in the ancient world. Now, until I read this a couple of years ago, it never occurred to me, but do you ever hear mention of prisons in the old law, for instance? There's no imprisonment, right? You either suffer physically for what you've done, or you pay some sort of restitution, or you're stoned to death, or you might be burned. But never does God legislate the children of Israel setting up prisons. And this was fairly common in this time, with one exception: ancient Egypt. Egypt had prisons. I'm kind of jumping ahead in my notes here. So the death penalty, a fine, or bodily mutilation were the typical punishments for crimes. But in Egypt, prisons were an option. So Joseph, rather than suffering under the typical punishment for his accused crime, was instead thrown into prison. Now, where was he imprisoned? Well, this is kind of a bad map up here. It doesn't really translate very well to the overhead. But do you see that red oval down there? You see that? Okay, that's right along the Nile River there. I hope you can see the Nile in blue at least, maybe, and kind of get a sense of where Egypt is at. That red oval encircles the city of Thebes, which at the time of Joseph would have been the capital of Egypt. It's the capital during the Middle Kingdom. The prison among the Egyptians was called the place of confinement. Now, there's no known sentence lengths, and when one was thrown into prison, it was presumably for life. Joseph really had no hope of getting out of prison unless Pharaoh decided to be merciful. And we see that taking place, right? With the butler, the cupbearer. He's in prison, presumably for life, but Pharaoh stays his sentence and brings him back. And remember, as he's leaving, Joseph says, "Hey, could you remember me before Pharaoh? And if it's possible, could you get me out of here?" Because otherwise, he has no way of getting out of prison. He's there for life. Some serve time. There's some indication. But mostly, it was for life. Now, I just skipped ahead of my notes and managed to contradict myself. How about that? I'm talking off the top of my head, and that's what gets me in trouble. So there is some belief that maybe the cupbearer and the baker were only in there for a bit of time, but mostly it was for life. Now in that story of Joseph there in chapter 40, we have the overseer of the prison. And he was assisted by a large staff of clerks and scribes. And one of the most important things for this man was to have good record keeping. And some of the historians and archaeologists that I've read that believe in the historical authenticity of the Bible, they believe that one of Joseph's main duties as the second in command or second in charge there in the prison, as the one who was deputized by the overseer of the prison, one of his main duties would have been record keeping for the prison. Which, if you think about it, makes a lot of sense. There would be a lot of things that would need to be kept track of. Perhaps if you had a man who had a certain sentence, you'd have to keep records of that. Perhaps you had to keep records of all the things that were taking place. If you had any altercations, if anyone died, all those sorts of things would have to be noted in records. And there's some thought that that's what Joseph was doing as the overseer of the prison's deputy. One thing, though, that I would like to remind us of is something that's said in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 12 through 17. Here Joseph is placed in an incredibly difficult set of circumstances. And it would appear that Joseph has been punished for doing good. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 12 through 17, Peter says, "For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear, having a good conscience, that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed. For it is better, if it is the will of God, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. One of the great lessons of Joseph's story is that it is better to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. Joseph did the right thing by fleeing from Potiphar's wife. And he went to prison because of it. But the message of Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3 is that God does not forget His people. His eyes are on the righteous. And Peter says it's better to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. In other words, you do evil, you're going to pay your consequences. That's the way God has set things up. But it's a better thing to do what's right and be punished for it. Now, that's something that's really difficult for us to wrap our minds around because we have this inherent sense of fairness and justice. Well, that's just not right. Why is it that I'm treated bad for doing good? This just doesn't seem just. It doesn't seem fair. Well, no, it's not. If we're looking for justice and fairness in this world, we're going to be disappointed. There's only one place where we're going to find justice and fairness, and that's when we leave this world. And we live in eternity with the one in whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. He is the just and the justifier. He is righteous, and it's only in His presence that we can expect justice and fairness. I bring this up because in our day and age, it seems like as things are working more and more against a biblical worldview, brethren seem to be getting a little anxious about it. And I think the story of Joseph is a good reminder for us. Joseph, who was all by himself, surrounded not by family, but surrounded by enemies, probably had no one close to him, was placed in this situation, and he prospered in it. Paul, in the book of Philippians, chapter 1, had been placed in prison, he says, for the testimony of Jesus Christ. And he says, contrary to what people would have you believe, this did not diminish my preaching of the gospel. It enhanced it. Because all those of Caesar's household have come to know that my chains are in Christ. Even the Praetorian Guard know that I am here because of my belief in a crucified and resurrected Savior. And he says to the Philippians in Philippians chapter 1 that this has turned out for good. What we thought was bad has turned out for good. And that's what we see in the story of Joseph. God was with him. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and His ears are open to their prayers. It is better to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. I'm going to have to wrap it up there. I'll just pause and ask any questions or comments as we draw this to a close for this class session. Well, Lord willing, we'll jump into Genesis chapter 41 here during the lesson time. And we'll look at chapter 41 pretty extensively because there's a lot of information in there about the famine, about the Pharaoh, and about the position that Joseph would have been placed in as the second in command in Egypt. We're going to do just a little bit of reverse engineering for this, but it does seem likely that the position that Joseph was placed in is the one that's known as the vizier among the Egyptians. It's essentially like a prime minister position. Over in Britain, they have a queen who rules, and the prime minister, when he's elected, comes to her, and she gives him permission to form a government in her stead. And seems to be a little like what Joseph, the role Joseph was going to play in Egypt. He was essentially going to be like a prime minister. Not that they had a democracy, but given similar powers. Basically, the head of the government under the authority and the auspices of the Egyptian pharaoh. So this was no small position that Joseph had been placed in. He was not just responsible for making sure that they got all the grain in the bins. There was more to it than that, and I think we can see that in the Bible's account. I'll leave that with you this morning, and Lord willing, we'll pick up here in a few minutes. Well, for those of you that weren't with us in the first session, we're talking about Joseph, but we're taking just a little bit of a different angle, trying to connect the narrative of Joseph with some things we see in history and archaeology, trying to make the man come off the page, so to speak. And in our first session, we talked about what takes place in chapters 37 through 40, roughly, talking about Joseph and his betrayal by his brothers. They actually sold him in Dothan, not in Shechem. He went to Shechem first, then he was betrayed in Dothan. Sorry about that, I messed that up earlier. And then we talked a little bit about how Joseph was thrown in prison for his accused advances toward Potiphar's wife, how that was unusual for an accused adulterer in the time that he was living in. This seems to be an act of mercy on Potiphar's part. Joseph does eventually come out of prison, though, and he does so under the most unusual of circumstances. And once again, we see in the life of Joseph the providential hand of God at work. We talked about how Joseph was a man of great capability. He rose to be the steward of Potiphar's household. He rose to be a man of prominence while he was in jail. And now we're going to see him rise to the very highest place that a man could rise who's not of the descent of Pharaoh, and that is what is often called the Egyptian vizier or prime minister. So in chapter 41, we know that Pharaoh has this dream. We've got the skinny cows and the fat cows coming out of the river. We've got the healthy heads of grain and the blighted heads of grain. No Egyptian can interpret the dream. The cupbearer at that moment remembers Joseph. It's been a couple of years. Joseph asks the cupbearer as he leaves, "Please remember me when you're before Pharaoh." A couple of years later, the cupbearer strikes him. There was this guy, this Hebrew, down in prison who interpreted my dream, and it came to be true. So Joseph is brought before Pharaoh. He interprets the dream. He advises Pharaoh on the right course of action. He says there's going to be 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. We should store up a lot in the first 7 years, so when the time of scarcity comes, we've got plenty of food. And he ends up not just feeding the Egyptian people with all that, but he ends up feeding a large portion of those countries around them. Joseph is handsomely rewarded by Pharaoh for his interpretation. And that's essentially a synopsis of chapter 41. Now, in this 41st chapter, we see several different Egyptian customs alluded to. First, in verse 14, you notice that when he comes out of prison, Joseph shaves and he puts on clean clothing. Now, a lot of times we interpret that as just simply Joseph being unkempt from his time in prison. But that's not necessarily the case. The fact that he shaves has to do more with Egyptian custom than it does really with the fact that he had facial hair. Egyptians were by nature a clean, a tidy people, and they were offended by facial hair. So it's not just a matter of Joseph getting cleaned up, it's also a matter of getting shaved because he's about to be brought before Pharaoh. Among his own people, among the Semitic people, the Asiatic people, facial hair was no problem. But among the Egyptians, they were offended by such things. We also see in verse 41 that Joseph is put in charge of all Egypt. And we're going to delve into that just a little bit deeper as to what exactly Joseph was doing. Later on in chapter 43, verse 32, when Joseph's brothers come up, Joseph talks about how they shouldn't tell Pharaoh that they're shepherds, and he alludes there to the prejudice of the Egyptians against Asiatics. They didn't like them, they didn't like to be around them, they sort of viewed them as an unclean people, if you will. And Joseph's warning to his family is typical of Egyptian prejudice against Asiatics. So let's look at the reward that Pharaoh gives Joseph. I'll turn back to the 41st chapter of Genesis real quick. In Genesis 41, down in verse 42. Well, let's go back to verse 39. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah. Aren't you glad you didn't have to say that? And he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. I think at times we might get it in our mind that Joseph was just put in charge of making sure that the Egyptians accumulated enough grain and food in those 7 years to stave off the famine that would come later on. But that's not the position to which Joseph was appointed. Now, true, he was in charge of that. That fell under the auspices of his office. But Joseph was much more than that. If you look at the description here in chapter 41, there's a lot more to this than just the guy who's responsible for making sure that they got enough food in 7 years. He's placed in a very prominent role. Pharaoh says, "Only in regard to the throne do you not have power." Let's go over to chapter 45, verse number 8. Keep your finger here in chapter 41. In chapter 45, verse number 8, Joseph says, "So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." This is one of those instances where Joseph alludes to the providential hand of God at work in bringing him to Egypt. And I want you to notice in that chapter 45, verse number 8, he says three things about himself. He says he's a father to Pharaoh, he says he's lord over all his house, and he is a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Now these three statements look on the surface like they're just simply sort of describing the same thing, but they're not. Each one of these phrases has a particular meaning. Each of these descriptions relate to a specific role that Joseph was executing in the land of Egypt. Lord of all the Pharaoh's house means that Joseph was the chief steward of Pharaoh's household. He was responsible for overseeing the vast agricultural estates that belonged to Pharaoh. He was also responsible for taking charge of the royal granaries where the agricultural wealth was stored. And that is always the image that comes to our mind, but that was just part of his job. There's two points that I want you to notice in this. Joseph was prepared for this task. And he notes in this verse that he was ideally placed in this situation to care for his family. He never thinks of himself more highly than he ought to think, at least not that we're told. Instead, Joseph sees himself as simply being in an advantageous position for his family. So first and foremost, he is a chief steward for all of Pharaoh's household. He would have been responsible for managing his estate, for managing all the agriculture of his estate, and of course overseeing the collection of all the foodstuffs that would help stave off the famine in 7 years. The phrase, "a father to Pharaoh," could literally be rephrased in Egyptian, a father of the god. Remember, the Egyptians were like a lot of ancient people. They believed their Pharaoh was, quite literally, a god. It's often used to represent the Pharaoh's childhood tutor. Now, this was unlikely given the fact that Joseph was 30 years old when he stood in front of Pharaoh. Very unlikely that that's what it referred to. It could also refer to the Pharaoh's father-in-law. Now, there's no record of Joseph having a daughter, and it's quite unlikely, since he was 30 years old, that he would have had a daughter old enough to have married Pharaoh at this point. He's been a slave. He's been in prison. This seems to be an unlikely explanation for what this means. This was also a designation for minor priests in Egypt's state religion. And there's no indication that Joseph served in that capacity either. Now, these were all common interpretations of what that phrase, father of Pharaoh or father of the god, could mean. This was also a title that was given to officials who served the crown well. Now, that makes sense, doesn't it? That makes sense. This is the reason why Joseph says, I have been made a father to Pharaoh. Because at the point he says this in Genesis 45, not only has he been overseeing the collection of all this stuff, he's now distributing it, right? He's distributing it to anyone and everyone who comes to the land of Egypt who's suffering under the famine. And presumably he's doing so very well because he's still in that position. So it seems when Joseph says, I have been made a father to Pharaoh, what he's saying there is, I have served the crown well, so to speak. I have been a faithful servant to Pharaoh. He also says that he is the ruler of all Egypt. In chapter 41, verses 40 and 41, we read this just a couple of minutes ago. Pharaoh says, only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And he goes on to say, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. As I alluded to at the end of our class session earlier and a little bit in my introduction, Joseph was likely placed in the position the Egyptians called the vizier or the prime minister. It's also called the chief of the entire land. That was a common epithet for that particular position. The duties of the Egyptian vizier were vast. He was essentially ruling the land of Egypt in Pharaoh's place. Pharaoh was essentially turning the rule of his entire land over to this man, Joseph, by virtue of his ability to interpret this dream. Most of our knowledge of the Egyptian vizier comes from the New Kingdom, which is about 1,000 years later, maybe a little bit less. But there were viziers in the Middle Kingdom, and we know that. Basically, the Egyptian vizier was a chief record keeper of the government. Record keeping was a big thing in the ancient world, just as it is today for our government. We saw in the case of Joseph, while he was in prison, that he was placed as the deputy of the overseer of the prison, and that likely had with it some duties of record keeping, and this would have been his duty as the Egyptian vizier as well. He also supervised the government, such as it was. He appointed lower officials of government to office. He controlled access, that says aces, but it's access, I dropped the S on the end there, controlled access to the presence of Pharaoh. He supervised construction work and industry in Egypt's state-run economy. He was in charge of agricultural production. So when Pharaoh makes those statements, and when Joseph goes on to say, I've been made ruler over all the land, if in fact he was serving as the Egyptian vizier, which those statements give us that indication, he had vast responsibilities. He had been placed in a mighty position. All for the sake of preserving his family. Only the vizier welcomed foreign embassies coming to Egypt. Now this is really interesting. Only the vizier could welcome foreign embassies coming to Egypt. How did his brothers first meet Joseph? They came to him looking for food, right? Foreigners came to him looking for food. This is just further indication that he had been placed in this position. Now, Joseph's rewards also have some significance. He was given a signet ring, and I think we're probably all familiar with the signet ring. Kings in the Middle Ages used to have that signet ring, and they'd use wax, and they put their imprint on it to show that they were the ones who had, well, composed the letter. It was by their authority this letter had been given. He was given garments of fine linen, which would have been royal clothing in this day and age. A gold chain was placed around his neck. We have many of these reward scenes in Egyptian art. And all of these reward scenes have with them a common thread. Many of these reward scenes have a gold chain being placed around the faithful servant's neck. So what we see taking place with Joseph is just typical of someone who has served the crown well. We also see that second chariot, which would have been second because Pharaoh would have been in the first chariot, right? The final thing Joseph is given is a wife. In chapter 41, verse 45, he's given the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. On is a city north of Thebes. It's known by the Greeks as Heliopolis. It's up there in the Delta Nile. I know this is way too small for you to see it. It's the farthest city north on the east side of the Nile River there. Heliopolis is just right above Cairo. Cairo wasn't founded until 900-something A.D. Heliopolis, though, was just a little bit north of that. And On was the center of solar worship in ancient Egypt. So Joseph is given the daughter of the priest who was responsible for overseeing the worship of the sun. The chief god worshipped in On was Re or Ra, the supreme deity of the Middle Kingdom. And Re, Ra probably sounds familiar. If you've done any sort of reading in Egyptian history, even just a cursory reading of Egyptian history, you'd know that the title Re or Ra comes up a lot. He was one of the chief gods among the Egyptians, the supreme deity, in this case, of the Middle Kingdom. This was no small matter. Joseph was given probably the most eligible bachelorette, if you will, in the kingdom. She was the daughter of the priest of the chief god of the Egyptian people. So his rewards were extensive. These are just a couple of things from Heliopolis. We don't have much left from the city of On. That obelisk on the right side of your screen is the only thing that remains of the ancient temple. And on the left side there in blue is an artist's conception of the temple of Re or at On. And as I said, it's known to the Greeks as Heliopolis. Now my entire purpose here is to emphasize not only Joseph's capabilities, but how quickly and how completely he had risen to this position. Just by virtue of being able to interpret a dream. Now, isn't it interesting that he wasn't given this reward after all these things had come to pass, right? Pharaoh didn't wait around to see, well, let's just see if what this young little Hebrew has to say is true. He didn't do that, did he? He immediately rewarded him, immediately placed him in this position, and he understood that his kingdom had a lot of work to do. And I think the sense of urgency here was probably what pressed Pharaoh most. He knew he only had 7 years, and when you've got to feed a nation for another 7 years, you've got to move quickly and move decisively. And I imagine that that factored in to Pharaoh's decision. But as I've mentioned several different times, we also should not forget that God had a hand in all of this. How God moved the heart of Pharaoh in this instance really is a mystery to us. We don't know. But I think we can say with a great deal of confidence that he was involved in this. Joseph credits it. He looks back at his life and he says, it is obvious to me, obvious, that God's hand has been involved every step of the way. Every time someone intended to do evil to me, good came of it. Good can come from evil. And Joseph saw it, and Joseph's life illustrates that. So Joseph was no ordinary man. Like Daniel, who we're going to be studying this week, he rose to prominence in one of the greatest civilizations in mankind's history. He sat atop the greatest empire of its time. He answered to no one but Pharaoh himself. He was ruler of the land. He was chief steward in Pharaoh's household. And he was so good at his job that he later says to his brothers, "I have become a father to Pharaoh. I have served him well and have been recognized for it." So Joseph was no ordinary man. This was no ordinary situation. We'll close here this morning and extend the gospel invitation. If you're here this morning and you've not accepted Jesus Christ as your Savior, we offer to you the opportunity to have your sins washed away, to be completely cleansed from those sins. Last week I was doing a VBS out in Martinsville, Indiana, and we were talking about the battles of the Bible. We talked about Gideon, we talked about Ai, we talked about... It was just last week, but I've forgotten. How about that? We talked about a couple other battles that are not immediately coming to my mind, but you know, it's just interesting in all those battles, like the one with the Amalekites, for instance, where Moses is holding his hands up, and so long as he's got his hands up, the children of Israel are victorious, right? They came out of Egypt with riches, but they came out of Egypt as slaves. They've been traveling for 2 months, and as Moses reflects on it back in Deuteronomy, he says they were weary, and the Amalekites were attacking their rear, attacking the most needy among them, the sick, the afflicted. And God said, because of the Amalekites' actions, that I'm going to wipe them off the face of the earth. What's interesting to me in that battle is that it required Moses holding his hand up. And in Moses' hand would have been that staff, right? That staff that he was holding when God first spoke to him at the burning bush. That staff was probably a shepherd's crook or a shepherd's tool, right? Because he was out taking care of his father-in-law's sheep. So he's holding in his hand this stick. And it's by that stick that he turned the Nile into blood. It's by that stick that all those plagues came. It's by that stick that the Red Sea was parted. It's by that stick that the Amalekites were defeated. You know, one person said, God sent two old men and a stick to deliver the people of God. He sent Moses and Aaron with just a staff. And yet that illustrates for us that God's means for salvation and deliverance don't operate according to man's wisdom. They come in ways that we don't expect. And that's true of the salvation we have in Jesus Christ. Because it was on a tree that the deliverance for mankind was provided. That tree was a symbol of slavery. It was a symbol of humiliation and embarrassment. It was not something to boast about or be proud about. It was a sign of shame. And yet that sign of shame became the means of God's deliverance. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, we urge you to recognize your state before the Lord. You are lost without Him. You're living on borrowed time. Because there is no expectation of life once your final death passes. If we can help you obey the gospel this morning, if we can help you take up your cross and follow after Him, we want to do that. God has provided the means of deliverance. We pray that you would look to the cross, that you would find the power of salvation that is there, that you might be freed from the guilt of sin that we've sang about in that song, that you might walk out of here in newness of life. If we can help you obey the gospel, please come forward as we stand and sing.